Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the University of Maine Orono for the 2019 Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability by E.J. Milner-Goulant, Tasso Leventis Professor of Biodiversity at the University of Oxford. The title of today's talk is An Optimistic Vision for a Sustainable, Wild, and Socially Just World. E.J. Milner-Goulant previously was Professor of Conservation Science at Imperial College London. Her research group, the Interdisciplinary Center for Conservation Science, focuses on research, outreach, and engagement projects across five continents. We'll also hear from former Senator George Mitchell at the end of the program. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Dr. David Hart, the director of the Mitchell Center.
It's a pleasure to have E.J. Milner-Goulant with us for the 13th annual Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. It began back in 2007. Long line of extraordinary speakers and remarkable leaders, including Nobel Prize winners, multiple winners of the MacArthur Genius Prize, National Academy of Science members, and if you missed any of them, you can go to our website, the Mitchell Lecture website, find out more, and most of them, there's recordings you can listen to. As you're about to find out, EJ leads an extraordinary program at the University of Oxford in which interdisciplinary teams of researchers have rolled up their sleeves to find solutions to complex conservation problems, to ensure that their work makes a difference. Many UMaine faculty and students are involved in similar work, so it's great to have EJ here for a few days. We've been learning about her work, and we've been getting great advice about the work we're doing here. There's a lot we can learn from EJ. How a passion for nature and a deep desire to help local communities can provide the inspiration for extraordinary solutions-driven collaborations. How even a sense of loss of unique species, of special places, of robust livelihoods, and vibrant communities can spark a lifelong quest to restore and to build a brighter future. How the best ideas emerge when you work together with people from different fields of knowledge and different walks of life. And as you'll see, EJ's optimism is palpable. Among other things, she's launched the Conservation Optimism Movement, a global community dedicated to inspiring and empowering people around the world to make a positive difference for nature. But her optimism is tempered by a clear-eyed recognition that the road ahead will be very challenging. We've definitely got our work cut out for us. She also pours her heart and soul into every aspect of this work, especially via her deep commitment to teaching and to mentoring. And you don't have to take my word for it. I reached out digitally to one of her colleagues in her center, Carlin Samuel, who had this to say about EJ. EJ is an incredibly generous person with her time, her support, her ideas, and her enthusiasm. Despite having a manic schedule, she operates an open-door policy with students and colleagues. She will always make time for you. One of the things that makes EJ's work so compelling is her deep commitment to building strong collaborations with community partners. That's also a central component of the Mitchell Center's ethos, and in the last decade, we've partnered with over 400 stakeholder organizations in Maine. Although it's impossible to give credit to all of them, right now at least, I'd like to focus on one particular partnership and to do so by remembering where we are, both the place and the time. We're on an island in the middle of the Penobscot River. And we should always remember that we're in the homeland of the Penobscot people, where issues of water and territorial rights and encroachment upon sacred sites are ongoing. The Penobscot homeland is connected to other Wabanaki tribal nations, the Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq, through kinship, alliance, and diplomacy, and the University of Maine recognizes that the Penobscot Nation and these other Wabanaki tribal nations are distinct, sovereign, legal, and political entities with their own powers of self-governance and self-determination. At the Mitchell Center, we're incredibly grateful for our many collaborations with all these tribal nations. And we have benefited greatly from the generous way they have shared their knowledge and encouraged us to share ours. Thinking about this place, this time, and the power of partnerships, please join me in welcoming E.J. Milner Gullin to deliver the Senator George J. Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you so much for that rather scary introduction. It's been a huge honor to be here for the last few days. It's the first time in Maine, and I've just loved talking to all the people, the faculty and students from the Mitchell Center and from around the campus who've given me such inspiration about the work that you're doing here. And I think it's a really trailblazing university that I've never seen anything quite so dynamically kind of cutting-edge science, but also partnerships, also reaching out to communities, and hugely interdisciplinary. And I just congratulate you all and David for such an inspirational center. Thank you. Right, so this is a kind of scary title, and I hope I'm going to give you a little bit of an optimistic vision for something that looks quite challenging. I thought the first thing I ought to do was to explain to you what I might mean by a sustainable world and socially just. And this is quite a simple way of thinking about it, but it's quite a nice kind of diagram that explains something of what we mean. And this is something that was done by someone called Kate Raworth, and she calls it donut economics for obvious reasons. So the idea is that in order for the social justice to happen, we need to have people, everyone in the planet, to be above a foundation of basic social needs. And you can see a list of things like education, energy, peace, that kind of thing. But we also need not to exploit our planet beyond its limits. So there's a limit beyond which, a ceiling beyond which, we shouldn't be exploiting our planet. And the safe space for humans is between those two, between the floor of social need and the ceiling of ecological sustainability. And she did a little quick analysis of where we were, and the red is where we haven't quite made it on the planet in terms of the social side, going inwards, and the red going outwards is where we haven't quite made it on the ecological side. And you can see we're not doing so well. So as a conservationist, I work on biodiversity and land conversion. So my area of interest is down the bottom of the donut, but I'm aware that there's the climate change pollution part of it as well, that all needs to be integrated. So I have been a professional conservationist, I guess, for 30 years. I'm going to confess that I started as an undergraduate in 1985. And since then, things haven't really got better for nature. So that's a bit of a fail. So this is the Living Planet Index you're seeing here, which is a compilation done by WWF every year, which is the number of vertebrate individuals in the world. And you can see that since 1970, we've had just fewer and fewer wild animals in this planet. And in fact, since 1985, we've lost about 30% of the actual individual wild animals in this world. If you look at from where I am, and this is pretty similar to where you are, basic kind of common species have declined quite dramatically. Like this is the Common Farmland Bird Index. We've got very large declines there. We've also had extinctions. So since I graduated, 9 bird species have been declared extinct. The bramble key melanis, little mouse, is the first documented victim of climate change. It was on a little island off Australia and didn't make it. And I'll just give you a little sound here. I don't know how many of you know what this is. This is the Yangtze River dolphin, or the Baiji, which is extinct on the planet, but you can still find it on the internet. So there you go, it's still alive. And so we have a prevailing narrative, I guess, about the state of nature that talks about the fact that wild nature is declining, It's too little too late, nothing's happening, and it's a sense of gloom and hopelessness. Okay, so where is the optimistic vision, you ask yourselves? So there has been movement at the international level in terms of trying to combat some of these issues. And in the last few years, we've had quite a lot of international policy made. So for example, in 2015, we had the Paris Agreement for Climate Change. We also had the Sustainable Development Goals that set a set of targets about how to make humanity get on a sustainable path to do with both poverty and nature. And the longest running one is the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was signed in 1992. But in 2010, there was a set of targets called the Aichi targets that were all agreed by many, many countries that give quite rigorous targets that we should all live up to try to improve nature. Maybe those targets didn't go far enough, but at least they were signed off on. The interesting thing about the Aichi targets is that we're now 10 years on, and the plan is going to be up for renewal in 2020, and there's a lot of busyness going on in the international community about how we're going to have a next generation of targets, while realizing that we haven't really made it on the first set. So there's quite clear evidence when you look at the indicators and the targets that biodiversity has not been getting better. If you look at the threats, the drivers that underlie these downward trends in nature, it's quite interesting to see that the largest ones are over-harvesting and agricultural activity. The agricultural activity is land destruction, and a lot of it is for livestock, for our food. The over-harvesting, a lot of it is timber. There's a lot of very complicated drivers, but what you can notice is that they are interacting things that happen on a range of scales. So when we think about how we're going to address these drivers of change and make a difference, we need to think on three scales. We need to think on the planetary scale, the macro scale, the large scale. We need to think at the meso scale, so landscapes, nations, that kind of thing. And we also need to think at the micro scale about the individual decisions that people make that cause those drivers of change. And if we're going to have any way of solving these problems, we need to think at all three scales and show how these scales interact. If you go to any given place, then of course these drivers interact in complicated ways within that place. So these are some pictures from one of my research sites, which is in southern Cambodia. And what we've got here is a beautiful protected area with some wonderful wildlife, which is being encroached for commercial crops, for sale, for subsistence hunting. It's also got a very large rosewood trade where they're extracting timber and taking it out. There's also local consumption for bushmeat and harvesting of plants for sale and for bushmeat. And so in any one place, you have to deal with large-scale drivers of international trade in timber and in agricultural commodities, and small-scale drivers of people eating meat around the park. So what's a conservation scientist to do? This is a group of my students and doctoral researchers, and here we are standing around trying to look happy, thinking about how we, as a group of academic scientists, going to make a difference. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples from our work that I hope will illustrate for you the approach that we've taken. It's actually very similar to the approach of the Mitchell Centre, which is heartening, and some of the things that we've managed to achieve and not achieve using that approach. The first one's about reducing illegal behaviour in Uganda's national parks, which was led by Henry Travers. So this is something that was a collaboration with us as researchers, but also a couple of NGOs, and also, very importantly, as you will see, the Uganda Wildlife Department. So if we think about it in terms of these different levels of drivers, our problem is concern about this large-scale poaching in the national parks. The macro-scale drivers is, certainly for some of that poaching, is demand for things like ivory in nations far away from Uganda. At the meso level, what we have is large-scale rural poverty, but also we have the way in which the park guards actually deal with that poverty in terms of antagonism and conflict with the local people. And then at the micro scale, you have individual households, individual people deciding how to get the income and the food that will feed their family. Am I going to farm or am I going to go hunting? What balance between those two do I have? I said that at the mesoscale is this conflict, and that conflict is partly because the people who bear the costs of national parks are the ones who live right on the border. And so here we have a picture of some children who are guarding their family's crops rather than going to school. And we also have a picture of people who've just been trained as law enforcement guards. So what we've found in these parks is that over the years, there's been a huge breakdown of trust, that local people are seeing things not changing for them, they're seeing costs and no benefits. And the Wildlife Authority's response has been to train more people with more rifles to go out and try to enforce the protected area. And that isn't working. So we came in, we were asked in, and we followed a kind of adaptive management cycle in trying to address this problem. The first thing we did was to try to understand the problem, trying to understand who was poaching and what the kind of characteristics of these people were through various different methods. Then we started to ask about what the motivations were for that. What are the underlying reasons why people are out there doing these things? Then we can start to ask both them and the park managers what kind of solutions they might see might work for the future. And we can use interviews, but we can also use kind of econometric methods to do that. Once we've thought forward about ways in which things might change, we can support the government and the local communities to implement those approaches. And importantly, the circle goes round. You don't stop there. You then keep looking and planning and understanding as you go round and round the circle to try to make things better. So the first question was how much illegal activity actually is there. We have concern, but that doesn't mean it's actually a problem. Well, sadly, it was a problem. So this is results from an indirect questioning method that meant that people were able to be truthful without incriminating themselves, which meant that we got better estimates than you usually get by just asking people directly. And what you see here is that the main threat is commercial hunting of meat for sale and ivory and things like that in some places. And 40% of our households said that they had hunted commercially for sale in the last year. So no wonder there's a problem. When asked why they were more likely to hunt illegally, and when we did our statistics, we found a few things. So the first thing is that we often have the narrative that says that poor people hunt because they need to hunt. Actually, it was the opposite in this case, that it was better off households that were hunting. The question is are they better off because they've hunted and it's made them better off, or are they able to hunt because they're better off and they're able to afford the guns and things? And it's both directions, I think. The other things were perhaps more obvious, which is that the ones who were out there hunting were people who felt that they had lost out from the park. They suffered crop raiding or predation, and therefore they were getting stuff back. And the other thing was that in Uganda, when you have tourists going to a park, a proportion of the fee from that tourist goes back to the communities, and that's called revenue sharing. And that's supposed to be the way that the communities are made to feel happy about the protected area. Unfortunately, it just makes things worse because you get all sorts of conflicts about the revenue sharing, and it's not fairly shared, and people feel they've lost out, and they get resentful. So the conservation kind of intervention is actually making things worse. So those were the things that our statistical models found. But also, when we talked to hunters, we talked to them in prisons, we talked to them in their homes, they were more clear about their motivations. It was about, this is an easy way to earn money, and that was really the main message that came. We then did a lot of these scenarios and experimental methods to try to understand which approaches to solutions might be best preferred. And we took a few solutions that are things that were brought up by the wildlife authorities or by the local people as possible. The first one was mitigating human-wildlife conflict. So the picture here is people digging a trench to stop elephants getting across into the cropland. The second one is social enterprises, things like beekeeping, things that are other livelihoods that people could engage in that would give them money. The third one is employing local community members as eco-guards to act as a bridge between the wildlife authority guards and the local communities. One was law enforcement. That's the thing that the Wildlife Authority are doing. That's what they want to do. But we're interested to see if the local communities liked it too. And finally, and this is a caveat, a kind of a cautionary tale about what happens when you sit in your desk at Oxford and think up solutions. We also think, wouldn't it be cool that, you know, there are already zones where people are allowed to harvest honey and fuel wood. Wouldn't it be cool if they could be allowed to harvest meat there too, because meat's what they want. So we thought we'd try and see if there was legal hunting in the zones, in the buffer zones, whether that would be liked. So this is responses from the Wildlife Authority in green and the local people in orange. And you can see that both the local people and the Wildlife Authority liked the positive incentive ones. They liked the human wildlife conflict, the social enterprises, and the eco guards. Interestingly, and perhaps against expectation, although the Wildlife Authorities liked legal law enforcement, the local communities liked it too. They recognised that this was a protected area, that this was their heritage, and that the animals within it needed protection. So they were okay about that. Neither of them liked our idea of legal hunting, so that one was out of the window. In order to be sustainable, you have to have things that people think are fair and legitimate. If they're not thought as fair and legitimate, then they're not going to be abided by in the long term, and it won't be sustainable, even if in the short run it works. So we asked local people about which of the solutions they felt were fair. And again, the three positive incentive ones were felt to be fair, and legal hunting they were a bit dubious about. How about behaviour change? Because what we're trying to do here is actually promote behaviour change. We're trying to reduce people's hunting. So one kind of behaviour change is to inform on people who they know are coming in to hunt. And all of the suggestions we made, people suggested that they would inform more if these were put in place, including the legal hunting. The $64,000 question is whether they would actually reduce their illegal hunting as opposed to these methods. And it was seen that the social enterprises, so the things that gave them other livelihoods, and the eco guards that gave them employment, were the things that would most reduce their illegal hunting, mitigating human wildlife conflict a bit, legal hunting, not at all. So we had some answers there from our research. But that doesn't take you very far, because then you have to do something about it. So the way that we did that was, because we had a partnership with the government, with the Wildlife Authority, we spent another 3 years. So this was 3 years' work. We spent another 3 years working with them to produce costed, prioritised action plans that were the Wildlife Department's action plan. It wasn't ours. We helped them, but they wrote the document. And that was about how do you do community-led crime prevention in these parks. And there were three pillars, which was effective relationships, effective law enforcement, and positive incentives. And the picture here is the executive director of the Wildlife Authority, and he's handing over this costed action plan to the head community ranger at Murchison Falls National Park for her to implement it with his blessing. So that was really good. And a further grant actually is now helping them to implement that. It's really important that the government department itself is on board and that they own this stuff. So in this case, what we did was that we did detailed research, long-time detailed research, with trying to understand individual incentives and why people were hunting. And that allowed us to provide engagement and support for these guys to actually change their behaviour. And when I say change their behaviour, I don't just mean the local people. What I mean more, actually and completely, is the changing of the behaviour of the Wildlife Authority. So these wildlife authorities have focused so strongly on law enforcement and guns. So in the case of Murchison Falls National Park, 200 people are employed as law enforcement rangers, and 6 people are employed as community rangers, engaging with the communities. They have to change that balance, and this action plan required them to change the balance in their budget. That's a very courageous thing to do, because just think, you're in the eyes of the international NGOs and you're in the eyes of the government. And if you change your budget away from law enforcement towards community rangers and some elephants get killed, all that the people see outside is, well, they reduced the number of guards and surprise, surprise, the elephants were killed. So it's a brave thing to do. But we gave them the evidence, we gave them the confidence to do that, because we had provided enough evidence that allowed them to think, yes, if we do this, it will actually reduce crime. So that's that one. Now I'm coming to another one. It's very, very different. It happens also to be in Uganda. I don't just work in Uganda, but this is a good example for me. And this is something about infrastructure. So our problem was the value of nature for local people not being accounted for in big infrastructure projects, and importantly, not being accounted for in the biodiversity impact reduction techniques that they're doing. So I'd like to start this case study with probably the most horrifying statistic that I've heard in the last couple of years, which is that 70% of the infrastructure in the world, by which I mean roads, railways, mines, towns, all that stuff, 70% of the infrastructure in the world that we will have in 2050, that we know already is going to be built in 2050, has not yet been built. That's quite something, isn't it? That's quite scary, but it's an opportunity too. So some of that is to do with the Belt and Road Initiative from China, but not all of it. So if we think about infrastructure, that is fundamental to a nation's development. People need electricity, people need roads, they need railways. So we can't just say no infrastructure. What we have to say is, can we do infrastructure in a way that's better? It's better for local people and that's better for biodiversity. So the macro drivers for this particular problem I'm talking about was this large-scale investment in infrastructure. The meso drivers in this case was a dam, a hydropower dam on the Nile River by Lake Victoria that was flooding farmland, flooding natural areas, and that was also displacing people. And then the micro drivers for this issue, well, in fact, it was not so much the local people's behaviour, it was the local people being put upon, a feeling that the local people were not benefiting.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features E.J. Milner-Gulland delivering the 2019 Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability about an optimistic vision for a sustainable, wild, and socially just world.
So when we do infrastructure, trade-offs are inevitable, and those trade-offs happen across those three scales that I talked about. So we need our national level development priorities. They need to trade off, and they are traded off, against local, national, and global biodiversity values. So we need to decide how we're going to balance those two. The thing that's a little bit less thought about is local people's needs and aspirations, and they're also traded off, both against development and against biodiversity. So when we're thinking about the biodiversity development trade-off, and that's better established in the literature, people use a thing called mitigation hierarchy towards no net loss of biodiversity. So that's a bit of a technical mouthful, but what it means is that when you put something in place, like a mine or a railway or something, you're going to cause some biodiversity damage. You can predict what damage you're going to cause. No net loss of biodiversity means that by the end of the infrastructure project, you should end up with the same, on average, net amount of biodiversity as you started with. So how do you do that? You follow this hierarchy. The first thing you need to do is try to avoid the most precious and valuable biodiversity, so you don't put your mine in the most precious and valuable place. Once you have done the best to avoid it, you'll still cause some damage, and then you have to try and minimize the damage you do by doing it in an eco-friendly way, by doing your mine or your dam in a way that's kind of trying to minimize damage to salmon runs or whatever it is. And those are both preventative measures. There'll still be some damage. When you've done that, then you have to try to remediate that damage. After you've finished, you can put the roads, you can kind of put the soil back, you can replant the areas, that kind of stuff. So remediation. There'll still be some damage left. When you've done all of the remediation, then you can offset. So what offsetting is that you're improving conservation values elsewhere. You're digging ponds, you're kind of planting meadows, you're whatever you're doing to try to improve biodiversity elsewhere. And those are post hoc compensatory measures. And then what we need to do is, if the amount of biodiversity gained or avoided or whatever is the same as the amount of damage, then you can say, I've made it to no net loss. If you've got more at the end, then you've made it to net gain. So if you have a housing development, for example, you could do your biodiversity offset, and that would be great, but let's think about the local people. And whatever biodiversity offset you do, there are going to be winners and losers amongst the local people. So the people who need housing are going to benefit. The long-term residents who get a nice biodiversity area are also going to benefit. The losers are going to be the people who used to use that open space, perhaps for dog walking or sports, and they might be the people who don't like change. So you have to think about those different groups and try to make sure that each of those groups get some kind of benefit. Okay, so that's a preamble to the project. This is one that was also with a government agency, a different agency this time, which is the National Environment Management Authority, who have oversight over the environmental impact of all development. We worked with a local NGO called Nature Uganda. We also worked with some international partners, including business, think tanks, and NGOs. And the researcher was Victoria Griffiths. So we were called in to do this project. We were asked to do it by the local NGOs and also this particular project, we were asked to do it by the National Environment Management Authority, NEMA, who are project partner in country. And the fact that the government agency called us in is important later. Okay, so that's Uganda, and it was just above Jinja on the Nile. So the thing that we were asked to evaluate was called the Bujagali Hydropower Project, which was completed in 2012. It was funded by the World Bank. Anything that's funded by the World Bank and international lenders requires environmental and social impact assessment and mitigation to no net loss. So there was a 200-page document that was saying all the things they're going to do. You can see where this is going. For social and environmental impact, which was done in 2012. We came in 2017, so 5 years later. One of the big things that it did was it flooded a waterfall called Bujagali Falls, and that was important because it was a spiritual site for the local people. And so it was something that was culturally very important heritage. What they did, what they promised to do in return, was the Kalagala offset. So it was a little bit further up the river, and the idea was that they would protect the Kalagala Falls and the Itanda Rapids, shown here. They would develop tourism activities as a way of getting new livelihoods, and they would conserve a forest reserve called Mabira Forest Reserve, and that would increase the biodiversity of the area. After we came in, the Simba Hydropower Project was started. So this is another hydropower project further up the Nile. It's still pretty much there. It's pretty close to being finished now. This was rather different because it was funded by the Chinese and the Ugandan government, so there was no legal requirement for environmental and social offsets. And in fact, there was great concern that it was actually flooding part of the Kalagala offset, so actually damaging the previous biodiversity and social mitigation. Okay, so yet again, we went in and did a deep, detailed study to understand the well-being and environmental impacts of these things. I'm not going to talk about the natural environment impacts that was done by the Ugandan team. I'll talk about the social impacts. So what we've got here is we've got the Nile River flowing, and we went to six villages, one on each side of the Nile, one set in the Bujagali Dam area, one set in the offset area, and one set in the new area with the new Chinese-funded dam. So you don't need to go into the detail. We looked at various different areas of people's well-being. The orange line circles are where people felt they'd lost out. The green is where they felt they had no impact. And the blue, if you can see it, is where they felt positive impact. So what you can see is very small amounts of positive impact on income. The majority of people in the two dam areas felt that they had been negatively affected. And the people in the offset basically felt that nothing had happened correctly. If you think about the rich kind of quotes that we found, most of the negative impact was, as we'd expected, livelihood focused. So it was about losing their farmland, losing their ability to get money from tourism, and losing fishing in the flooded areas. But there was also quite a strong theme around the cultural heritage and the flooding of the Bujagali spiritual site. Interestingly, we also had all sorts of social, relational, conflictual things that we didn't expect, and I've just put a few up here. So feeling hoodwinked, feeling that the compensation fund itself brought conflicts between families, that neighbours were displaced and they moved away and they lost their social fabric of their neighbours, and even within their families that they felt that there was conflict between husband and wife of various kinds. The positives, those very few positives I showed you about, some of them were a lot of them were aspirational. We recognise that the nation needs electricity. If we have more electrification, the nation will develop and that will be good for all of us. And then there was a little bit about people using their compensation to buy farmland elsewhere. So, as I said, what we found was that the offset was basically a paper offset. Nothing had happened. So what we did then was we used the methods that I mentioned before to try to understand what the people actually wanted the offset to focus on. And we took ideas from the local communities, and we also took ideas from the 200-page management plan that hadn't been implemented, and we asked them about what they'd like to do. Interestingly, in this case, none of them were interested in individual-level benefits. They weren't interested in employment for individuals. They weren't interested in individual payments. They were interested in community-level benefits. They wanted conservation of their forest reserve because they felt that it brought climate stability and ecosystem services. They were interested in community development, like piped water, and they were interested in tree planting. So that's what they wanted the biodiversity offset to focus on. Okay, so that was great. And, you know, we did a nice bit of research. This was a very controversial project. And I'm quite interested that the government brought us in, particularly that the agency that was supposed to be overseeing all this stuff brought us in. And the World Bank was set to refinance this dam. And they did it, actually, in the third year of our project. They did these negotiations. They did refinance the dam. So although I think we can't say that we had any kind of definite impact, what we did do was we allowed our government agency partners to have a set of options, which they knew which the local people wanted. It also allowed our NGO partners to write a letter, which was evidence-based, based upon the work that we did together, to the government agency saying, this is what we think you should do as you refinance this dam. This is the way that we could make people's lives better. So I can't say whether that's going to work or not. It was only done in August. What I can say that worked was that we did massive capacity building at the national level. So government authorities, consultants, ecological consultants, NGOs, all really understand no net loss now. They understand how to think about gain and losses for biodiversity and for people, and they're much more capacitated now than they were in understanding these issues, which is why they brought us in, I think. The other thing that was cool, and this is a complete opportunity that we didn't expect, was that the government were writing national legislation about biodiversity action, so biodiversity mitigation for infrastructure, and there's lots of new infrastructure coming in Uganda. What we managed to do, and this is the draft legislation that's hopefully going to go through, and you saw the National Biodiversity Offset Strategy, that's what it was. We introduced the and social. So and social is now in the title and it's in the document, so that now whenever people do infrastructure, they can't, by law, ignore local people's concerns. So that was a real unexpected win. And we've also had international guidance, and we've trained a lot of people in NGOs and governments worldwide about this. So in this case, where we had a problem about value of nature for local people, we did the detailed research at the local level. But the main wins were about engagement and support at the national and international levels, which may or may not feed back to the actual local people on the ground. So what I am trying to say from these two examples, and there are many from the Mitchell Centre that would be exactly the same, is that what we want for really high-powered academic research that's going to make a difference in the world is you have to do this detailed bottom-up understanding of the system, while bearing in mind the bigger picture, both the academic bigger picture and the real world bigger picture. And you have that interplay between the two that will allow you to make a difference and produce top class research. But kind of spanning that, you need to have engagement and collaboration with NGOs and government partners. And you need to be nimble. You need to be able to go around constraints and find and utilize opportunities when they come. The other thing that I think you really, really need is staying power. So these are just some random pictures from a project that's my longest running project, which is now 29 years, which is conserving the Saiga antelope in Central Asia. And the fact that I've been working there for 25 years as an academic researcher and starting to engage in technical advice, in NGOs, in all this stuff, and children's education means that I can now, as an academic, take the position as a kind of honest broker, take the position as someone who can be relied upon to provide advice and to support people in any kind of organization who want to do stuff. And so I think this kind of long-term engagement and being trusted and having that independent voice is really helpful. And I actually think the reason why we were brought in Uganda was that we had that external voice. We were able to do that research and to say those things that people internally might find it hard to say. So I think that's a really useful role of an academic. So to come back to the beginning, I said that in 2020 we've got a hugely challenging and exciting year to come when all these international agreements are going to be renegotiated and we can potentially have a new deal for nature and for people at the global level that will hopefully be signed up to by many nations. So that's starting, and you know, we've got a process towards it, but our ambition at the moment perhaps is weak. So at the moment, you know, we're not quite sure the extent to which we're going to do something that's really good, that's really new, that's actually going to change those trajectories that I showed you at the beginning, the downward trajectories for nature. I find this a very interesting graph about which tells me, which is kind of reflects social change. It reflects the process of social change. So as a conservationist who spent 30 years banging my head against a brick wall, perhaps, it may feel like conservation isn't going anywhere, that we're kind of walking through treacle and nothing's really changing, or certainly not as fast as people might want it to change. But we have to recognize that the way that people change their minds is that you have this great long period of stasis when things are happening, but we can't really see it. And then you get a flip when suddenly society changes. So this graph shows over the years, a long period from 1787 to 2015. So you have to take the long view on these things. The number of states with legislation about various different policies. And what you can see is that you get long periods when nothing happens, and then you get states, large numbers of states taking it up, and then it goes federal. So that's the way that society changes its mind. And that's why we as conservationists or as sustainability scientists have to keep on walking through that treacle, because suddenly the treacle's going to turn. And do we think that in conservation this is happening? Do we think that in climate this is happening? Maybe. So a year ago, a 15-year-old girl sat outside a parliament building on her own. A year later, this is the number of school children. So we've got New York, we've got New Zealand, we've got South Africa, we've got India, we've even got people marching in Afghanistan for climate. And so that is quite different. I'm not saying that we're there, I'm saying that social change does happen. So as David said, I founded the Conservation Optimism Movement about 3 years ago. And that was partly in response to the fact that it's very hard to be in a profession where you get up every morning and you see things getting a bit worse. Not always, but, you know, certainly on the global scale. And actually, that's not true. Actually, there are many successes at local levels often. There are many things that are going right. And compared to how it would have been if there hadn't been conservationists getting up every morning, we're a whole lot better off. So the conservation movement is trying to bring together people to help people to feel that that's the way forward. So conservationists are able to feel that there are other people on their side, there are other people doing the same thing who are also walking through treacle, and for whom, and really I started this movement and the amount of need and appetite for it was extraordinary within the conservation world. It needs to be more than that though. We can't just have conservationists feeling good about themselves and empowered. We have to have the whole of society wanting to save nature, wanting to have a sustainable, socially just and wild society. You might guess that this is a random selection of my family who've been press ganged into pretending that they're conservationists. No, but the point is that it doesn't matter what walk of life you're in, we can all play a part. You know, we can all feel like, you know, we can do our bit to save nature. And so I think the other thing to think about is, can we take that mitigation hierarchy that I showed you for infrastructure, and can we think about it in all aspects of our daily lives? So can we avoid impact? Can we minimize our impact? Can we remediate and can we offset? I've done it with four R's there in a way that is a little bit nicer than the language I just used. But, you know, there are ways that individuals can make a difference. So I hope that I've given you an optimistic vision for a sustainable, socially just and wild world, and thank you for listening.
Now it's time to turn things over to President Joan Frenimundi. Even though she's been here for less than a year and a half, the university and the state are already benefiting tremendously from her vision, her passion, and her dedication. So please join me in welcoming her.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. It's my great honor to introduce Senator George J. Mitchell. And we always look forward to Senator Mitchell's visits. We're delighted that your stay on the tarmac in LaGuardia was relatively brief, all things considered, today. And so thank you for making it here. Senator Mitchell grew up in Maine, born in Waterville, One of his several books, his memoir, The Negotiator, tells the story of his roots in Maine. It's fascinating, a terrific way to understand the senator and his experience. He's a Bowdoin College alum. That's okay. We'll take that. Served as a U.S. senator from 1980 until 1995, the U.S. senator from Maine. U.S. Special Envoy for Northern Ireland and the architect of the Good Friday Agreement. An incredibly distinguished career as a statesperson, as an international leader, and as a person who has been very generous with his time and intellect and resources to the state of Maine. I thank Senator Mitchell for his generosity, for being here for this important lecture, for helping us to think about the ways in which today's complex challenges, tomorrow's complex challenges, require solutions that promote engagement of people from a variety of backgrounds, from a variety of stakeholder positions, and that depend upon respect and mutual understanding and conversation to move us forward. Senator Mitchell, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, President Farini Mundi, for that very generous introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your presence today and for your warm reception. It is true that I went to Bowdoin, but whenever I come here, I always point out that my brother and sister are graduates of the University of Maine at Orono, and so they keep us all very much well informed of what's happening here. It's been about a year since President Farini Mundi joined us, placing Sue Hunter, a great president, and you're doing a great job yourself, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. And it was especially enjoyable to hear our guest, EJ, talk about the great work she and her colleagues are doing on innovative collaboration. It's encouraging to learn about their commitment to addressing the challenges of sustainable development and the creative solutions that they're developing to these interconnected economic, social, and environmental problems. I think her talk placed in context, as well as any speaker I've heard, the nature of these problems, that they cannot be seen or resolved in isolation from their surroundings, both human and natural. She focused on issues facing people living halfway around the world. So I'd like to begin with a few comments on the world and the role of our country in it, in dealing with these and other international challenges, and then speak briefly on challenges closer to home here in Maine. I begin by going back in time. The three major land wars that devastated Europe in the 75 years before 1945 are fast fading into history. Few now recall that in World War II alone, 63 million people were killed in a world in which the population was less than a third of what it is today. The relative peace since then is not by chance. It's the product of institutions and alliances created by the Western democracies led by the United States. Those institutions included the United Nations, NATO, the European Union. They are as vital to peace and stability today as they were more than a half century ago. Because despite undeniable progress in much of the world in recent decades, still old social and economic challenges have persisted and new ones have arisen to face us in the 21st century. They include rapid and technological changes, dramatic increases in trade other changes that have upended long-established patterns of work and daily life for billions of people all around the world, leaving behind hundreds of millions who lack the skills needed to succeed in the 21st century. Wealth has been created on a scale without precedent in human history. But a sharp rise in income inequality has concentrated most of that wealth in a very small number of people at the very top, while incomes stagnate or decline for those in what was the broad middle class. Human beings first appeared on Earth about 300,000 years ago in Africa, not far from the scenes that EJ showed in her slides. But it was not until the early 19th century of our era that the world's population reached 1 billion. The most recent billion, the seventh, was added in 13 years. Although the rate of growth has slowed, the absolute numbers continue to rise, especially in countries plagued and often devastated by conflict, corruption, poor governance. This has contributed to the largest movement of people across national borders in all history, creating immigration crises in every part of the world. And those immigration crises, in turn, create political crises. Climate change threatens heavily populated coastal areas and island nations, generates more and more intense droughts and storms, increases desert lands, decreases arable farmlands, raising the level of food insecurity for millions of people around the world. It is in the self-interest of the United States and the American people to join, indeed, given our position as the dominant world power, to lead in dealing with these and other challenges, working with others as appropriate, and in particular, with our democratic allies around the world. While we compete in many ways, we should not think of our allies, in particular our European allies, as adversaries. They are also our partners. And whether in dealing with the challenges I just listed or in confronting competing non-democratic powers, such as China or Russia or Iran, it is in our national interest that we do all we can to help people everywhere to be free, democratic, and prosperous. The sustainability challenges we face in Maine are in some ways similar to the larger issues described earlier. The need to improve economic and community well-being while protecting ecosystems on which all life depends is a never-ending struggle at every level. Just think, 150 years ago, many of the forests for which Maine is now famous had been clear-cut, and more timber was being exported from Bangor than from any other region in the world. When I was growing up, the Penobscot River and almost every river in Maine and around the country were so badly polluted with industrial and municipal waste that high among the least desirable places to live were immediately adjacent to rivers. And that's where I grew up, where my family lived, right on the banks of the Kennebec River in Waterville. And I can still remember to this moment the daily sight and the smell of the noxious chemicals discharged from textile and paper mills that lined the river, the water laced with scum, with debris, with logs. The object of everybody who lived near rivers then was to move away from the smelly rivers. Many of you here, students and others, weren't alive back then, so you'd have a hard time imagining how pervasive those problems were and how intractable they seemed at the time. But we've made great progress in addressing these and other difficult problems as a state, as a nation, and in some parts of the world. In closing, I want to commend and echo EJ's optimism. I'm an optimist too, despite the many challenges we're facing, and I sometimes worry that optimism is in short supply. But I also know that credible optimism requires a delicate balancing act. It calls upon leaders, political, social, educational, and others, to create an atmosphere in which people believe there can be success in solving their problems without sounding foolish or unrealistic. And I'm particularly optimistic that there are, in this audience and in other parts of this university, more EJs, and somewhere in this state, more Ed Muskies. I'm confident that the experiences they gain in working to develop solutions in collaboration with partners inside and beyond the university can lead to new solutions, new opportunities, and better futures for all of us and for our children. Thank you again for being here, and thank you for your support for this center.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was E.J. Milner-Gulland, Tasso Leventis Professor of Biodiversity at the University of Oxford. She recently delivered the 2019 Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability at the University of Maine, Orono. We also heard from former Senator George Mitchell. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.